Hello and welcome to Sleep Money Travel, the bonus mini-series for Sleep Money. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. We normally talk about the business and finance news of the week, but on this series, we're going deep into the business of travel. And specifically, today, we have the amazing Jay Sorensen at IdeaWorks. Jay, how are you?
I'm delighted to be on your show.
And you are basically the person who knows everything there is to know about airline miles and the economics thereof. And so what we are going to do is we are going to do this deep dive into what are airline miles, why do they exist, where did they come from, and who is making money from these things. And the answers might well surprise you. They certainly surprised me. So all of that is a very special midweek treat right here, coming up on Slate Money.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
And the capital of Moldova is? You get bonus points if you get this one right.
I have absolutely no idea what the capital of Moldova is. So I think we can start off this amazing episode of Sleep Money Travel by learning the capital of Moldova. What is, Mr. Jay Sorensen, what is the capital of Moldova?
It is Chisinau.
Okay. And is it a place I should visit? Is it a good place to go? Does it have good food?
Well, have we actually begun the interview?
This is all on the record. Basically, it's like you thought you were coming on Slate Money to talk about like wonk out about the economics of airline miles, but in fact, all we want to know is can we get good food in Chisinau?
Well, I actually was in Chisinau and I had a wonderful Georgian meal. But Moldova is a very challenged spot in the planet in terms of its politics, its economy. And it's people. It's Moldova needs a whole lot of care and attention from the rest of the world because it's in a tough place.
Okay, I will keep my plans, my Slovene plans. I have a whole plan of doing a kind of Spomelnik brutalist architecture tour at some point. So I'll keep those plans. I won't change that to going to Moldova.
There's these things that are nicknamed Stalin's birthday cakes, and they were gifts of the Soviet Union. And they're typically like the main building in some of these former Soviet capitals, like Riga has one, Warsaw has one, and I don't know if Bucharest was gifted one, but these are brutalist structures that that have a tiered sort of effect that look like a birthday cake or a wedding cake, and they're pretty hideous, and they're a delightful reminder of what the Soviets did in terms of damaging architecture.
I stayed in one of those ones. I feel like the Sheraton Hotel in Sofia, Bulgaria, is one of those. And which is actually the perfect segue, because the reason I was staying in the Sheraton Hotel in Sofia, Bulgaria, is because I was giving a talk there, but I was also accumulating my Sheraton points, which I was getting by using my Starwood American Express card, and so I have stayed in many Sheraton aligned properties over the years. They locked me in through my card, and I became a loyal Starwood person. Of course, that's all over now. They got bought by Marriott. But this is exactly what we wanted to talk to you about, which is like, why do these points exist, and who is making money off them? And so I guess the place to start is just, we should have done this ages ago. If you could just introduce yourself and explain to us who you are and how you managed to get into this curious corner of the capitalist world.
Well, I am an airline professional. I worked, I started my airline career in 1984 working for, actually before that, for a small little regional airline that I worked for when I was in college. But my first real airline job was with an airline called Midwest Express that was based in Wisconsin or Milwaukee. And I worked there for 12 years and was director of marketing. And while I was there, helped start the frequent flyer program. And I left the airline in 1996 and started the IdeaWorks company, consulting firm. And one of the areas that we work with airlines worldwide is on the topic of loyalty marketing. So it's been a, you know, it's been a great ride. And I really enjoy working with these programs because they can be so, so very creative.
Creative. I like that word. It's you know, I feel like creative is one of those words which occludes a multitude of sins. But I want to get into this idea. So I think at first glance, people look at what you call a loyalty program and go, well, yeah, it's a loyalty program. What happens is if I use your product a lot, if I fly on your airline a lot, you'll give me little, you know, points, these magical little things. And if I accumulate enough points, then that will get me status and upgrades and free flights and make me feel special and you know, get me on the plane earlier and all of these other wonderful things. And that it will turn into a kind of virtuous cycle where points beget loyalty and loyalty begets points. And then I just wind up flying on your airline to the exclusion as much as I can of anybody else's airline. And it just kind of works in a closed loop between the airline and the passenger. Is that how they started, or were they always really thought of as more of an actual sort of financial profit center?
Well, I don't think you need me for this show. I think you've nicely encapsulated what these programs are all about. They, you know, they've been around for more than 30 years, and they were originally designed to be nothing like what they are today. The very first programs were in the U.S., and American, Delta, and United were among the first to offer a frequent flyer program. And they were offered by invitation, and they were only offered to those who had the most amount of flying. And the reward structure was very similar. It was very simple. It was only first-class seats. Because the airlines realized that they had excess capacity in first class, and there was no capacity control. So if there was a first class seat available, you got it. And eventually, the programs grew in complexity and in size, where they did add economy class. But the big game changer for frequent flyer programs was the marriage of credit card activity with a frequent flyer program.
So give us some dates here. Like, when did these things start? When do they move into economy class? And then when do they become financialized?
30 plus years ago, these programs started. And then probably, I would imagine, 25 years ago, the first credit cards began to show up. And that really changed the financials of, well, it no, it remade, forever remade the financial relationships for these frequent flyer programs. When I consult with my airline clients, I say the strongest, the best programs are designed to rest on a three-legged stool. And the three legs are communication, the loyalty effect, and the cash generated by the program. The loyalty effect is what you've talked about already, and that is if you give someone the opportunity to accumulate points for tied to purchase behavior, they will, and it is a type of addiction. You know, there was a social experiment done in Chicago, the University of Chicago, probably a decade ago, in which a professor gave a group, defined for a group, if you did this amount of work, you got paid cash for it. Another group, if you did the same amount of work, you got points for that work that you could convert into an equal amount of cash. Well, the surprising result was that the group that was working for points worked harder than the group that was working directly for cash. So that demonstrates the power of the loyalty effect. The second leg of the stool is communication, and that is when you are enrolled in a frequent flyer program, there's two-way communication that's occurring. First, the consumer, the member, is giving up their data in terms of what they have purchased, their purchase behavior, because they're earning points for it. And then the airline has the ability to communicate with the member to talk to them about promotions. It creates a very direct relationship between the airline and the consumer. And then the third thing is probably where this program is going to focus its attention, and that is the credit cards. And this is the cash that's generated by a frequent flyer program through the sale of miles or points to partners such as banks.
So you just kind of blew my mind there. And yes, you're absolutely right. We're going to talk about the credit cards and the massive influx of cash that they brought into the entire ecosystem. We'll do that in a minute. But I'm really fascinated about this communication idea. And it had never occurred to me before that that this is a kind of 25-year-old big data play, if you will, and that back in the days when people were buying airline tickets through travel agencies, or even today, I guess, if you buy an airline, I don't know what happens today. I'm very confused about how ticketing works today. But back in the day when people were buying airline tickets through travel agencies, there was a huge degree of opacity that the airlines didn't really know who was sitting in those seats with those tickets and had no ability to communicate with those individuals directly. And the idea of a frequent flyer number was that the travel agent would just like write down the frequent flyer number along with the ticketing request, or maybe it would happen at the gate. And then that would allow the airline to know exactly who was in that seat and to communicate with that person directly in a way that they weren't able to do hitherto.
There's also another story that's tied to this opacity that you're talking about, and that is in the initial reservation systems, the airlines did not know what fare was paid by the customer when they booked through a travel agent. They eventually did know probably weeks or months later when the actual paper ticket was processed, and that process was called revenue accounting. And it's a very bizarre and complicated art. So why we have miles is testimony to that difficulty of capturing what the customer had paid for the ticket. So the airline said, you know, when someone books a reservation originally, we did not know what they paid. And they said, well, what do we know about them? Well, we know where they get on the airplane. We know where they get off. Oh, what's that tied to? Well, that's tied to miles. And so that's why we have miles for frequent flyer programs, as opposed to points. And if you look at, you know, the rest of the world in terms of loyalty, it's always based upon spend. It's only in the airline business that we have this rather bizarre situation in which it's based upon distance, which today bears little resemblance to the value that a customer may have to the airline.
Wow. So it's this atavistic kind of holdover from the days when everything had to get reconciled with pieces of paper. That's why we still talk about airline miles. And that's why people still think in terms of miles.
Yeah. Yeah. The system, we believe that the system is going to eventually change to a revenue-based system. What happens at many airlines today is very clunky. And, you know, one of the most important things about a loyalty program is that when a member should know what their behavior will yield in terms of benefit. And if you go into a Starbucks, you use your loyalty card, you have an idea of what the payback is. In the airline business, it has become so opaque in terms of, and it really reduces the loyalty effect. And that is, you know, what you accrue from a flight is tied to where the booking class is tied to the distance, is tied to multiple different things. So the airline industry over the course of time has tried to make this mileage-based system more reflect the cash paid by a customer. And in doing so, has really created a mess of it. And so you have programs such as Southwest or JetBlue that clearly tie accrual to the amount of money spent by the customer. And even with American, Delta, and United now, you see that accrual is tied to what you're spending on the airline. So we believe that the rest of the world is going to eventually adopt this method of basing accrual upon spending, which then, of course, removes... Then it begs the question, why are these things called miles anymore? And eventually that, too, will change.
So that's the perfect segue for us to get into the other great way of accumulating miles, which is just using your credit card to pay for groceries. We'll come back to that in a second.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Okay, so here's the meat. Credit cards. I can accumulate however many miles unless I'm a super road warrior, business traveler type, you know, there's probably a limited number of miles that I'm going to be able to accumulate by buying the occasional $400 ticket to go visit my aunt in Duluth. The real place where people see thousands and thousands of miles just accumulating automatically month in and month out is through loyalty cards and through these credit cards that every time I buy a iced coffee on my Amex, like, I get these magical points. So walk us through a little bit, like, how this started and how this changed everything.
Well, let me begin by asking a question. Do you actually have an aunt in Duluth?
I do not have an aunt in Duluth, I have to admit. I kind of made up my aunt in Duluth. I apologize to my fictional aunt in Duluth for killing you off just as soon as I invented you.
So you're trying to establish some street credibility with the Midwestern here by pulling out this random Duluth thing. Okay.
To be honest, I've never even been to Duluth, and I'm not sure I could find it on a map.
Well, I know everyone wants to be a Midwesterner nowadays, so I understand the desire completely. Credit cards. So credit cards have effectively become another method in which airlines sell travel. And I like to say they sell travel a mile at a time. Right now, for most of the major U.S. for the major U.S. programs, American, Delta, and United, 60% or more of the miles that they are that are being accrued are from credit card or partner activity. Within the partner activity, the vast majority, probably 90% of it, is tied to credit cards, with the other 10% being linked to other retail behavior, hotels, and car rental bookings. So credit card activity has become a giant component of frequent flyer finances today.
And to oversimplify, basically the way it works is that the credit card companies, the card issuers, pay millions and millions of dollars to the airlines in return for the points. And then you get like a whole secondary loyalty cycle going on with the credit cards that people will be loyal to using one credit card rather than another credit card, because if they use this credit card and they wind up earning a whole bunch of miles on American or United or something like that.
Yeah, the airline wants to have a continuous presence in the lives of its consumers. And while you may not fly every week, you certainly use your charge card perhaps on a daily basis. And so that is just a reminder. It creates attachment between the consumer and the airline when they use the credit card to accrue points, and the points are tied to travel. It creates this daily bond between the airline brand and individual consumers. And so I'm looking at some numbers here in terms of the programs in the United States. It's very meaningful income. Because if you look at the American Advantage program, when you take the revenue that they generate from the Advantage program sale of points to partners, on a per passenger basis, it's over $15. If you calculate it on a per member basis, and the Advantage program has about 100 million members, it's $31 per member per year. There are programs out there in the world that have pretty amazing rates of revenue when you look at it on a per passenger, per member basis. The Qantas program in Australia, Qantas probably has more than 20 banks associated with its frequent flyer program. And in that case, they're nearing $100 per member revenue associated with the frequent flyer program and its relationship with co-brand credit cards.
And the associated cost, I mean, you know, they obviously get lots of lovely money from the banks in return for the miles that they're selling. The associated cost is now they're on the hook for providing seats and upgrades and that kind of stuff.
Is that
a real cost? Like if the average revenue per member is $30, what's the average liability per member? Is that quantifiable?
Well, what I like to say is the airline is a seat factory. When you run these programs correctly, the marginal cost of providing a reward is very, very low. And so, you know, it could be, you know, the marginal cost of providing a reward could be $10 to $20. And that's the direct cost associated with adding a passenger to a flight. So the programs were originally designed to say the following. We believe that rewards that we give to our members really don't have a full cash cost to the airline, because we are managing the inventory availability in a way that we are offering only excess capacity for reward travel. And that has largely remained true today, except that we've seen a lot of pressure because there's just so many miles that have been accrued by members that this excess capacity, when combined with really high load factors on airlines today, really is pushing the limit of that original premise. And so airlines have had to begin to provide seats that they could sell on a cash basis to consumers. They've had to do that because over the last 5 years, it's just been a tremendous amount of pushback from consumers about, hey, you aren't giving us enough reward seats. And that's been true. However, in the last 5 years, I think the airline industry has done a lot of work to address that problem.
So what they're doing is they're basically taking seats out of the bucket that they expect to sell and putting it into the bucket that they expect to give away. And every time you take a seat out of a bucket that you expect to sell, all of that sales revenue just disappears.
Right. And so, you know, let me return to the economics of these programs in terms of how the credit card program works. So an airline will strike a deal with a bank, and these relationships now are far more complicated than they were originally, because they begin to touch all of the points of revenue that these card programs generate. So there's a card portfolio out there, and that card portfolio is going to generate revenue from the annual fee that's charged. In many cases, it's waived for the first year, but that's revenue to the bank. And then there's also what they call SIN fees, and that is if you're paying late, you know, you're going to pay a fee for that. That's revenue for the card program. Interest when you are charging and you're revolving, you're paying off on a monthly basis as opposed to paying off your balance. You're going to incur interest expense. Well, that's revenue for the bank. And then, of course, there's the big part is the interchange, and that is whenever you use your card at a retailer, at a merchant, there's a percentage, perhaps 2% or more, that merchant pays for the processing of that credit card transaction. So all of this lines up on the revenue side for the bank. Now let's talk about the cost side. So on the cost side, when you have a credit card and you're obviously going to accrue miles, those miles are purchased by the bank from the airline and deposited to your account. And the per, you know, what those miles are purchased for can run from a penny and a half to 2 pennies per mile is what the bank is paying for those miles. Plus, if you have a card that's going to have certain benefits associated with it, like free baggage, early boarding, or some of the more expensive cards have lounge access, there's even a financial transaction that occurs between the airline and the bank when those services are used.
Oh, so it's not just a flat fee or whatever. There's actually someone is like keeping track of, if I have a platinum card and I use that to get into a lounge, like that gets noted somewhere, and it's when I actually use that service that the bank will pay the airline for it.
Yeah, and so it's going to be at a discounted price because obviously the bank is buying in tremendous volume from the airline for these services. It's going to be at a discounted price, and there may be caps in terms of, you know, if you use that service X times per year, well, then X plus one, the fee is no longer charged to the bank. They cap it just to restrict, to control the exposure, cost exposure that the bank may have. In the past, I would say 3 years, the negotiating advantage has really been on the side of the airline to extract a lot of revenue out of these programs from the bank.
Because the banks are basically selling a commodity product, which is this payment device, and the only way they can distinguish themselves from any other credit card is by having a glistening long list of rewards that you get for using their credit card rather than someone else's.
Well, for a component of the marketplace, they simply demand an airline-associated product, an airline co-brand product. And so the banks struggle with that. But there's also this weird dynamic of the banks are also competing with the airlines with their own bank-issued cards that are oftentimes travel-oriented and you know, Chase and Citi and American Express all have card types that award points that can be redeemed for travel or cash back. And so this market is this idea, this market is pretty frothy at the moment in terms of the economic pressures on these portfolios, as well as these competitive issues that exist.
So when you say frothy, you mean that the number of miles being issued and the price per mile and all of that is at kind of relatively high levels that we might expect maybe to fall back at some point?
Well, I'll tell you that there's this whole house is built upon one thing, and that is the continued ability of banks of to charge, I would say, relatively high merchant fees to retailers. In countries in the world, in Europe and Australia, for example, those merchant fees have been capped. And it has really changed the dynamics of the credit cards in those areas. In the U.S., we presently have a very open marketplace in terms of, you know, no, not an open marketplace, a marketplace that has not regulated these things. In terms of the government has basically said, you know, we're not going to become involved as a regulator of these fees. We trust the marketplace to determine what's going to happen. Well, the marketplace is comprised basically of Visa, MasterCard, and American Express, and all the banks that are aligned behind these brands. And, you know, as long as these high interchange rates are out there, you know, we'll have card products like we have. But I must confess that I have followed this a bit, and the premise of the government becoming involved is based upon, well, if you cap these fees, the merchants, of course, will pass on the savings to the customer. In the analysis I've seen in the Australian and European markets, the analysis I've seen has suggested that hasn't occurred, that the merchants have pocketed the difference. And so I think that the status quo will prevail in the U.S., and that means that we will continue to have these very rewarding co-brand products. But they certainly are, you know, I can't stress how much these cards mean to the bottom line of airlines in the United States.
So, I mean, that certainly explains why you don't have rewards debit cards. I mean, debit interchange fees are regulated
Correct.
By Dodd-Frank and they're very low, and so
Right.
no one's going to make money off those. I am interested, though, in the idea that, you know, on the one hand, we've had regulation of interchange of credit interchange in Australia, and on the other hand, you tell me that Qantas still has more revenue from these things than any other airline. It's like it doesn't seem to have harmed them that much.
Well, you know, Qantas just has a huge penetration. I think I was reading that Qantas estimated that more than 30% of all credit card volume in the country is tied to a Qantas-linked credit card, which is amazing. You know, when you think about the impact that has on the economics of a country, it's amazing. It's stunning.
It's amazing. So, I mean, if I'm a Qantas credit card holder, I can see that value in terms of, hey, I get a free flight on Qantas at some point.
Right.
If I'm not a Qantas credit card holder, if I'm just, you know, an American, say, flying on Qantas for my, you know, to visit my aunt in, you know, Melbourne, who also doesn't exist, then do I benefit as well insofar as Qantas has this lovely revenue stream that it wouldn't otherwise have, and therefore it can charge me less per seat because it has other ways of making money?
Oh boy, that's you know, I don't know that I'm going to jump in and weigh in on either side of that logic. I'll say this, that you as a, because Qantas is part of an alliance, you know, when you do take that flight on Qantas, let's say you're a member of the American Advantage program, and Qantas is part of that of the One World Alliance, that your travel on Qantas can accrue points in your Advantage membership. So, I mean, there's that benefit to you that's very direct. But in terms of, you know, do these, well, you know, I will say this, you know, during the last economic downturn for the U.S. programs, the credit card portfolios were the only things making money for the airlines. And so to a certain extent, when we breezed through the 2008s, through 2008, 2009, the portfolios held by American Delta United probably kept those airlines afloat.
And they actually did a bunch of deals, if I remember. I vaguely remember Delta like just selling some enormous number of miles to American Express in like a big one-off
deal. Yeah, and I think to American Express, and I think American also, I believe they had a loan that was guaranteed against future mileage receipts from Citi. So they were, I mean, for a while, they were the only profitable component of those airlines. And, you know, this is good stuff from a financial perspective, because it takes away the revenue from these programs is very stable, and airline fares and airline fuel expense oftentimes are not stable. So it does layer in something at below that's a stable source of revenue that helps counteract the far more risky side of the airline business, being passenger fares and the price of fuel.
Wow.
Perhaps you could call it a hedge against that type of a risk.
Oh, it's just predictable recurring income, basically, which is, you know, something everyone wants and has seemingly transformed the airline industry. I guess I only have one more question for you then, which is that is this particular advantage for the very large airlines who can credibly claim to fly anywhere that you're going to want to fly and who you can realistically be loyal to, compared to smaller airlines who might not have as many routes, and so you know, it doesn't matter if you're loyal to them, you can't fly them because they don't go where you're going?
Oh, there's tremendous market power from these programs. And I recall, you know, there was a I won't go down that path. No, there is tremendous leverage that airlines enjoy from these giant programs. I mean, look, they all have, you know, the big three, American, Delta, United, all have 100 million plus members. And when you think about that reach, what they can do with that membership in terms of, you know, let's say that there's a particular strategic need in a market to offer triple points or triple miles, you know, you can imagine what that does to a competitor who doesn't have that type of reach. So no, they are very powerful, certainly very powerful engines of loyalty.
And just like back of the envelope, if I have 100 million members and I'm getting $30 per member per year, that's $3 billion a year, which is real money even to an airline.
Yeah, I mean, these programs, the big three programs, and actually I'll include Southwest, you know, it's multi-billion is what they're generating revenue from these programs now on an annual basis.
And everyone has a favorite airline. People, you know, it's almost impossible to run into anyone who doesn't go, oh, that airline's really good, that airline's really bad. You know, people have strong opinions on that. Do loyalty programs have, I feel like I'm not clear whether people have the same opinion of loyalty programs and whether it's all like tied up in your opinion of the airline. Is there like a different ranking for loyalty programs than there is for airlines, or is it pretty much the same?
Well, every spring we undertake a giant exercise at my consulting firm in which we go out and do thousands of queries to ask the question, who has more available rewards? And that that exercise indicates that there really are differences. The distinctions are less in the U.S. for domestic travel. At one point, they were. But generally speaking, the big three airlines, American, Delta, United, have all, you know, they all have similar levels of reward availability domestically. The challenge has been, if you accrue more miles, you're going to want to probably spend them on a trip overseas, using an economy reward or a business class reward. And there we have found that there's a big difference in terms of, well, there's far fewer business class rewards than there is to meet demand, we believe.
Huh. So that because I guess the cabins are smaller, they just don't have as many seats, and there's a lot of people who want them, and a lot of those seats are being sold for cash.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, but, you know, to give you some specific numbers, we looked at, if you look at short-haul reward availability, I'm looking at a spreadsheet right now. We looked at short-haul rewards, and among the U.S. carriers, essentially 25,000 miles or points are equivalent. I mean, if you spend $25,000 on a credit card, it's going to generate 25,000 miles in Advantage, Mileage Plus, or Sky Miles. It also will generate 25,000 points in the Southwest program or in the JetBlue program. So if you consider that, you can kind of say, you know, miles and points are almost the same thing. When we did our queries, 100% of the time, we were able to find a reward on Southwest Airlines. That number drops a bit as you consider other carriers. So for American, it was 92.9% of the time. The same number for Delta, 92.9% of the time. And then United was 78.6% of the time we were able to find an economy reward for in their top markets. I can also give you the numbers if you want to see how they're different for long-haul flights, if you wish.
Yeah, tell me about what's in, I mean, obviously Southwest doesn't offer international business class seats, but for those who do, what's the availability?
Well, funny enough, Turkish Airlines was on top. And Turkish Airlines for a long time was at the bottom of our rankings. But over the course of time, they obviously have done a lot of work on making their rewards, long-haul rewards, more available. But for long-haul markets, 98.6% of the time on Turkish, we were able to find a seat. If you begin to look at the U.S. carriers, it drops down to 72.9% of the time for United, 71.4% of the time for American, and then 51.4% of the time for Delta.
Wow.
So that's an interesting stat as well. We also look at the average price. And so that's a pretty telling statistic as well. The average price for these carriers. And when we look at their top markets, we also obviously look at the reward price in miles or points. And for 2018, Southwest came in at 7,579, which was by far the lowest. The average among the U.S. carriers was 19,616. So in this particular case, you see Southwest coming in far, far below. United, for example, the average reward price was 28,500.
Wow.
So there is a difference in these programs in terms of their how they price their product and how they make reward seats available to their members.
I feel like that's a whole other episode, which I will be diving into, is like how to pick your mileage program and how much you should care about it and how much effort you should spend on it and how much you should just like not.
You know, yeah, it's interesting. You know, American Airlines a few years ago released a statistic in which more than 25% of their members who had taken a reward had actually never bought a ticket on the airline.
So that was the first time they'd ever flown on American was when they redeemed like some miles.
The first time they had, yes. And so, well, I don't know if I could say that, but the first time that they had, you know, among those who had taken a reward on the program, 25% of them, more than 25%, had never bought a ticket. So they had accrued all those miles principally through partner activity and obviously principally through the credit card. And so it's interesting that that's an example of, you know, there's a dynamic there in which a good number of members, weirdly speaking, were not a customer of the airline.
Wow. That's absolutely fascinating. So, Jay, thank you so much for explaining this to me.
You're welcome.
Learned so much from this. I am now, for the next 30 minutes, I'm going to be an expert on all things airline miles, and I'm going to forget it all. But this was absolutely fascinating. I am now going to resuscitate my aunts in both Duluth and Melbourne so that I can find an excuse to cash in some airline miles and go visit them. Thank you so much for your time. It's been amazing talking to you.
You're welcome.
So thank you all for listening to this special bonus edition of Slate Money Travel. We'll have more on wonky travel-related economic questions next week.